Good. Okay. Morning, everyone. My name is Pat Ward. I'm the administrative law judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as the procedural hearing officer for this hearing. This is the hearing on the application of NSP for an advanced determination of prudence regarding whether several resource additions are prudent, including several in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. This is North Dakota Public Service Commission case number PU-17-20. The record will show it is a little past 8:30 a.m., September 26, 2017. We're at the commission hearing room on the 12th floor of the state capitol in Bismarck, North Dakota, which is a time, date, and place set by the notice of filing and notice of hearing issued by the Public Service Commission on June 30th. On March 20th, NSP filed its application for advanced determination of prudence. The notice of filing and notice of hearing for this hearing specified the issue to be considered and determined as to whether the additions would be prudent. On September 19, the Commission and the ALJ were notified of a proposed settlement between PSC staff and XL Energy. My understanding is the parties now plan to use this previously scheduled hearing to prove up the settlement. Mr. Simpson, would you please state your appearance for the record? And
Zev Simpson, Briggs & Morgan, on behalf of applicant Northern States Power Company.
Ryan Long for Northern States Power Company.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong?
Mitch Armstrong. Mitch Andrew. Armstrong, Special Assistant Attorney General on behalf of advocacy staff, and with me is Sarah Cardwell. She's the lead for advocacy staff in this case.
Okay, and will Ms. Cardwell be questioning today at all?
No.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco, Commission Advisory Staff, with no one with me today.
Is there anyone present other than witnesses for the company or the commission who may want to testify today? Okay, seeing none. Any opening remarks from the commissioners? Chairman Christman.
Well, thank you, Your Honor, and welcome everyone to the Public Service Commission hearing room. Usually kind of always nice when we see a settlement, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't still demand thorough review on our part as well. I've been through a lot of the testimony pretty thoroughly, learned a lot, but I still have some questions, I think, as we go with the witness. But a couple broad areas that I feel like, for me, I need more information on. One is for the company, what's being displaced? We talk about the additions, the additional generation here, but in previous discussions with the company, I've never sensed that the demand curve for power is growing that sharply in the next few years to just add 1,550 megawatts. So I'd like to talk about what this would replace, and especially in light of the fact that it was beyond what the company supposedly was talking about a year ago until the RFPs came back. So I think we need to explore that some. I'd also like to hear from witnesses the thoughts on the difference in my mind between cost and price. A generation source that doesn't demand fuel, of course, can be on the market at a very low price. But if subsidies are involved with that, and the same consumers have to pay out of the tax side of their bills in their lives to make that a reality, is the cost necessarily less to them? And so, to me, that's a distinction between the cost and the price. And do we have some responsibility for that side of the equation too, or do we just completely ignore that? Would we just take all we can get, or do we have some responsibility in that regard? I also want to discuss a little bit. I've not seen an ADP before that was bundled like this, and when I read the ADP law, every reference that I see in there is to a singular project. And so is this an all-or-nothing proposal, or does the commission have the option to break it down and approve certain projects and, well, not approve, but authorize the advance determination of prudence on certain projects, but not on the others. This concept of bundling, I think, is new. And then lastly, in the settlement, it was pointed out that it was a point of difference, but I don't know what the status then when the ultimate settlement was agreed to on Mr. Heidel's proposed 60-40% financial incentive plan that he discussed in his original testimony. So I need more clarification on that. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's good to be here, and I agree with Chairman Christman that it's nice to have a settlement and see how the parties work through all the issues and where everybody came down. It seems pretty clear that there is a lot of cost savings provided by these projects. And so my questions revolve more along the lines of, and the discussion I'd like to have, is how does this type of investment affect the sustainability, the economics of the existing system, the baseload, if you will, system? And is there anything in that regard that we need to be concerned about or thinking about when we entertain this magnitude of a new renewable investment? So otherwise, I think that we, the parties did a great job spelling things out. I appreciated the settlement and hope to have a good discussion with everyone this morning.
Mr. Crocius.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good to be here as well. And some of the questions and thoughts I have were already mentioned. One of the things that and Commissioner Christman pointed it out, as I was reading the testimony, I would read about the positive economic impact for the communities in which the wind farms would be sited near, in proximity to. But it is worth noting that North Dakota is bigger than just several communities. We have a robust lignite industry in the state as well, and does some of that energy production get displaced as a result of bringing this wind online? Another question I have, and it would relate to what Commissioner Fedorchak just indicated, and that is, this isn't the only project out there. There's a tremendous amount of wind coming online right now or being proposed, and it's not just for NSP. It's I think every company in this arena is looking at it in a similar fashion, in that the production tax credit is reaching the expiration date, if you will, in terms of starting to be ratcheted down to the 80% to the 60%, and then finally the 40% phased out in 2020. So I had questions on that. How much is coming online, not just with this proposal, but with others? Because we have to look at what is our energy policy and strategy. Would be a better word for it, not just as a state, but as a country. So we have to weigh all this out. Are we going to see such an influx that it tips the balance and it's no longer as favorable for consumers if other areas that are where we get power from become less efficient, and that drives that cost up in the process? So just some things to flesh out as we go through the conversation and the day. I look forward to hearing some answers on those questions. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, very similar to what the other two commissioners indicated as well. So with that, we can move on.
Thank you, commissioners. any opening remarks, Mr. Simpson?
None, Your Honor. We'll leave that to the witnesses.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong?
Same, Your Honor.
Okay. Would you like to mark these exhibits and put them into the record?
Yes, Your Honor. We've marked a series of exhibits on the exhibit list, NSP 1 through 12, are our application, public and trade secret versions, the direct testimony of Mr. Chandarana, public and trade secret, the direct testimony of Mr. Martin, public and trade secret, the rebuttal testimony of Mr. Chandarana, public and trade secret, Mr. Chandarana's opening statement, his supplemental direct, as well as the first revised settlement agreement. Those are NSP 1 through 12, and then marked as PSCs 1 through 3 are the direct testimony of Mr. Heidel, both public and trade secret, as well as the opening statement of Ms. Cardwell. Through discussions with advocacy staff, we asked that those exhibits be stipulated into the record, subject to Your Honor saying okay and Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle not objecting.
Okay. My understanding is NSP exhibits 1 through 12 and PSC 1 through 3 are stipulated between staff. Is that correct, Mr. Armstrong?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the company. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle, do you have any position on these exhibits?
No.
Okay. Then I will admit exhibits NSP 1 through 12 and PSC 1 through 3 into the record. Now, Mr. Simpson, do you want to call your first witness?
Yes. We'll call Mr. Chandarana to the stand.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Chandarana. It's my duty to advise you the penalty for perjury in this state before you testify. Perjury is a false statement under oath of material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison or a fine of $10,000. In some cases, both may be imposed. Having been advised of this penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Be seated. Mr. Simpson.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Chandarana, Mr. Chandarana, I just left you copies of the public record just for your reference. Also in front of you should be your opening statement. If you could read that into the record, please.
Sure thing. Good morning, Commissioner Chrisman, Commissioner Fedorchuk, Commissioner Karashis, advisory staff, advocacy staff, and others here today. My name is Akash Chandarana, and I am Regional Vice President, Rates and Regulatory Affairs for Northern States Power Company, the applicant in this proceeding. I'm here today to support the settlement agreement between Xcel Energy and Commission advocacy staff, granting conditional prudence for the seven projects that make up Xcel Energy's 1,550 megawatt wind portfolio. There's fundamental agreement between the company and advocacy staff that adding these resources to the NSP system is prudent and that doing so will drive down overall system costs. In fact, under both our analysis and staff's analysis, the wind portfolio will provide over $1 billion in system-wide savings over its life compared to the most economic alternative resources. While the wind portfolio does not strictly conform to the Commission's need plus least cost planning paradigm, the substantial long-term cost savings from the resource additions demonstrate their prudence and support the company's request for an advanced determination of prudence in this case. Advocacy staff's direct testimony supports this conclusion. Prior to the settlement, the main disagreement between the company and advocacy staff related to certain conditions to the ADP proposed by staff's consultant, Mr. Heidel. Rather than litigate over these conditions, we have worked with advocacy staff to settle on conditions to an ADP that can work for both the company and our customers and are therefore in the public interest. More specifically, the company has agreed to all of Mr. Heidel's proposed conditions except one. That condition would have limited the company's recovery of development costs for the construction of the wind portfolio to an aggregate fixed amount and would have required the company to pass 60% of any savings under that aggregate fixed amount back to customers with no corresponding ability to recover any costs above the fixed amount from customers. Although Mr. Heidel viewed this condition as an incentive, the company was concerned that its asymmetrical allocation of development risk was inconsistent with the way the company developed and budgeted for the wind portfolio. Consequently, the company and advocacy staff have agreed to treat the costs of the wind portfolio consistent with traditional rate-making principles. Under the settlement agreement, the Commission's ADP, if granted, would recognize the prudence of the wind portfolio up to an aggregate amount of development costs. However, consistent with traditional rate-making practices, if the company's actual development costs are lower than the aggregate amount agreed to in the settlement, only those actual costs would be reflected in rates. By contrast, if the company's actual development costs are higher than the amounts identified in the settlement agreement, then the company can come back to the Commission to demonstrate the prudence of those additional costs. We believe this treatment of development costs is fair, reasonable, and consistent with the public interest. The settlement agreement reflects the fundamental prudence of the company adding the 1550 megawatts of wind to our system and provides for reasonable terms and conditions to govern the requested ADP. It also recognizes that both the company and advocacy staff have built a record supporting the Commission's granting of an advanced determination of prudence. For these reasons, I urge you to adopt the settlement agreement. I look forward to addressing any questions you may have. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Simpson?
No, Your Honor. This witness is available for cross-examination.
Mr. Armstrong?
No questions.
Ms. Cardinal? That's right. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No questions.
Commissioners? Commissioner Christman? Commissioner Crocious?
In your testimony, and I think it's been included in several other parts as well, it has been included, the need for bringing this online in terms of demand doesn't occur until 2025. That's when you would actually have a deficiency. Is that correct?
Commissioner, that from a capacity perspective, I think that's what you're referring to. That is when a capacity need arises on our system. The wind resources that we're talking about today are largely energy-based resources. And as I talk about in my testimony and in the application, which is Exhibit 1, what really drove our decision here was economics and the fact that these resources are at a very low price. So I think that's what really drove our decision-making here.
Mm-hmm. I was somewhat surprised that during the RFP process that it seems like you were pleasantly surprised by the bids that were coming back, that they were lower than anticipated. Is that correct?
Commissioner, that's correct. It's been a few years since we had gone to market. I think the last time we had gone, it was a bundle of projects that involved the Courtenay project, which is based here in North Dakota, and the prices that came in were significantly lower than the last time, and so that was where the surprise came from.
Mm-hmm. And that equates to the $1.6 billion, I believe, is the figure that has been provided in estimated savings?
That's correct, and that's the number that our analysis demonstrated, and Commission staff or advocacy staff through their consultant provided a pretty robust set of testimony that supported a similar number as well.
Okay. Can you help me out on this? And just to clarify, and I'll have to backtrack just a little bit, but on the dates in terms of the request for proposal, part of it happened, it seemed like, in October, and that was seemed like a question and answer period, if you will, but the RFPs were actually sent out in 2017. Is that correct?
Commissioner, I think, and I'm going to just make sure that I get it right myself. So I'm going to actually go to the ADP filing itself, and which is Exhibit 1. And really the way that the RFP played out was we developed a process that what we were really trying to strive for is to issue an RFP in 2016 so that we could gauge what the market pricing was for wind at that time. And part of the reason why we wanted to issue that RFP was also to have a litmus test, so to speak, of our self-build projects to see what the competitiveness of those projects were to what the market bore. And so the overall process was let's go ahead and initiate an RFP process in 2016. Let's negotiate and see if we can drive that RFP to conclusion at the end of 2016, early 2017. And then bring forward all the necessary regulatory filings in 2017 so that we could go ahead, get the approvals that we need, and go ahead and make sure that we can hit the 2020 timeframe on the PTCs that we need to. Does that help?
It does. I guess what I'm really trying to figure out, and part of it may be trade secret. So the 5% that would have to be invested in the project. And I was just when I was looking at the timeline, I was, since the RFPs hadn't even gone out yet, but 5% was already invested in the project in 2016 in order to qualify for the production tax credit, because this project is heavily reliant on that. When I was looking at the timeline of when it started and when it actually, I'm just trying to figure out, okay, so in 2017 you have RFPs coming in, but you've already invested 5% in the project without having bids. And that's what I'm trying to you know, get my brain wrapped around.
Sure. And we could probably have done a better job of explaining this. And so there's, I think one of the challenges here is that you're talking about two sets of projects. And so when we're talking about the RFP, we're talking about third parties that are bidding in, so independent power producers such as NextEra, for example, bidding in either their power purchase agreements or their BOTs or whatever project structure that they're looking for or proposing. From our vantage point in that situation, what we do is we make sure we contract with that developer that we don't absorb or bear any of the PTC risks in that situation. So we leave it to them in that situation to figure out how they're going to make sure that they qualify for the 100% PTCs. And so that's the RFP side. What you also have is the self-build side. And that's where I think some of this gets really squishy and kind of blurs together. And on that front, we as a company were proposing four projects, and we also wanted to make sure that our customers got the benefit of the 100% PTCs. And through that, what we did is we being XL Energy, and I'm going to use that term instead of NSP, one of XL Energy's subsidiaries entered into an agreement with Vestas, which is a turbine manufacturer. And that's how we went through and then qualified for the PTCs. And so, or have put ourselves in a position to be eligible for 100% PTCs. We've gone and made an investment in wind turbines. And when we start to talk about the actual commercial arrangement with Vestas, we do get into some trade secret pieces there. But it was a very creative and innovative transaction that allows us to utilize our entire XL Energy footprint and that arrangement with Vestas, which allows the self-build projects to meet that qualification. So I'm hoping I'm getting closer to answering your question.
You are. It just seems as that somewhere there's a warehouse of turbines that have been purchased in advance without being designated at the time necessarily, but then those can be used in order to capture that expenditure can be used to capture the PTC or to meet the safe harbor provision of the PTC and construct in 2017 despite the 2016 timeline on that.
Yeah, Commissioner, every developer has to make a choice or make a decision on how they're going to try to meet this safe harbor provision. And once we get into the are there a warehouse of turbines or not, I'm now way past my knowledge base in terms of how they're actually doing all of that. But you know, the real idea here was to, from our perspective again, with our self-build projects, is to utilize our 8-state footprint and to look at how we could maximize our buying power and enter into an agreement with Vestas to make sure that we would have enough turbines in place for wherever we were going to build these wind projects so that we could make sure that our customers got the benefit of the 100% PTCs. And so that's, I can speak to that very well. And as it pertains to the RFPs and the third-party developers, what I can tell you is that our contracts with those developers is how we manage that risk to make sure that our customers get the value of the 100% PTCs. What those developers do to meet that safe harbor provision, we talk to them about it, but ultimately they have to make sure that they accomplish that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I don't have any other questions at this time. I may circle back.
Who wants to go next? Commissioner Crisman?
Thanks, Your Honor. And first of all, are you the only witness? You're up for all questions, and then if they're out of your domain, we'll bring up a different witness, or is there another witness coming that certain types of questions should be held for?
Please ask Mr. Chandarana whatever questions you may have. He'll answer them to the best of his ability. Mr. Martin is here, who's our Director of Resource Planning, should there be more detail.
So the line of questioning that Commissioner Crassus was on was one of the things I was going to ask about, too. And so just to further clarify in my mind, I kind of got the impression from reading the original application that the whole RFP process was almost an advance response to the Minnesota Commission's mandate for more renewables. But in fact, the company had intended to add some wind regardless of that, is what I'm understanding you to say now, before that came out, in light of the fact that it sounds like you had an agreement with Vestas before that ever happened.
Commissioner, I mean part of what I'm getting at here is we have to go beyond Minnesota and the NSPM company. Public Service Company of Colorado has a wind project called Rush Creek, which was discussed and developed far before the Minnesota wind projects were being discussed. And we also have wind projects that were proposing to build down in our New Mexico and Texas operating company. And so it's bigger than that. And so the process that we developed for this wind acquisition portfolio, again, what I was trying to get across is we needed to develop a process so that all of our regulators could see that our self-build projects and the price that we're delivering those projects at is very competitive to market. And we needed to develop a process, or we wanted to develop a process, that allowed us to demonstrate that across the NSPM footprint. And more specifically, in Minnesota, there is a requirement for a certificate of need, and there is a requirement that there is a bidding process that occurs. And that particular process takes multiple years when the company bids in its own generation. And so we wanted to develop something that allowed us to move quicker and move faster so that we could secure the 100% PTCs. And so I mean, for me, there was a process that we used in order to bring in third-party bids and also to measure the market competitiveness of our self-build projects, and that's what this RFP process was.
Okay. I asked in the beginning about what would ultimately be displaced, because I've never heard that your demand curve is spiking that sharply to need this much additional energy. So can you go into that?
Sure. I can touch into that, and then Mr. Martin can definitely go into it in far more detail than I can. When we bring on this wind, I mean, what will happen is the fact that it's at the price that it is, and when it blows, it's going to get dispatched. It's going to be released by MISO, and it's going to run. And as a result of that, depending upon what time of day that is, other generation resources are going to be called not to run, or they're going to run less. And by that, it could be peaking units if it's a really hot day. It could be baseload units, depending upon what kind of day it is. I think the biggest piece of it all is, again, as I mentioned before, the wind is energy. And what our other units provide, especially our baseload units, provide is capacity. And so even though our capacity or our demand curves are not going up, they still are at the same level that they are, and so we need that capacity on our system. But if there's specific resource types that you're curious about in terms of how or whether they're going to be dispatched or not when this wind comes on, it's probably an area that Mr. Martin can speak to much better than I can.
Okay. Okay, then I think I will have some questions for him, because I guess one of my main questions is, I get it, it's different to me whether it's just sitting there and either one is dispatched or the other is dispatched, or is something removed from the system and no longer available.
Yeah, and the best of my understanding, it's you don't remove, they're not removed from the system. It's a matter of dispatch and it's a matter of bidding. And so that's where we, that's really what we get into.
Okay, well, we'll go into that more with him then later. The cost versus price thing I mentioned earlier, you have stated, and it sounds like advocacy staff agrees, that there are significant savings to the company's costs in this. Let's say, for example, they were very small, but savings nonetheless. Do you view it as our and the company's responsibility to lower that cost to the company and cost to your consumers, no matter how little, and completely ignore the cost to the federal treasury that the same consumers pay into? Or at what point do we take that part of the cost into consideration?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, from a policy perspective, again, what I can speak to is there is a federal policy in place which provides this benefit, and it's available to those that want to take it. And what you have before you in this record is that these savings savings, I'm using savings and costs differently because I think you're viewing them differently, that the savings that are coming back to our customers are so significant that we should move. And I understand your question is, at what point do you hit a breaking point that maybe it's a closer call? I don't know, because I think a lot of this is, from my perspective, what really spoke to us is that you're talking about a really large number. And that really large number of savings to customers comes from the fact that we were willing to move on a federal policy that exists. And so if we chose not to and to let that pass, that would not result in the same savings to our customers. And these are material. So from my perspective, it's there. It's going to step down. And we had an opportunity to really go after it and make some use of that. And that's why we made the decision that we did.
Are the price savings so substantial that they exceed the cost savings to the federal treasury, or no?
Commissioner, I don't think we did that kind of an analysis to see what the offsetting, you know, tax credit implications are compared to what the savings are to our customers. What I do know is that it's available to anyone who wants to take advantage of it. And from our perspective, from a business perspective, we really viewed, you know, $1.6 billion in savings to customers is something that we should take advantage of.
Would this be an efficient and wise move if the PTCs weren't available, if it was standing alone?
You know, honestly, the 100% PTC is one of the biggest drivers in terms of how we approached this whole entire acquisition. I mean, speed was of essence to us, so that we could make sure that we get to in servicing by 2020. And so as we became more aware that the PTCs were going to get extended, that caused a pivot for us for sure. We had always intended on adding a significant amount of wind as part of the resource planning effort that we had talked about a few years ago. But once the 100% PTC extension happened, that it definitely kicked us into a gear of analyzing and understanding what the savings could be for customers.
I mentioned in our opening comments my concern about an ADP process becoming a bundling process. Does the company view this as kind of an all-or-nothing thing with this ADP, or does the company view it as something where the commission will evaluate these and probably grant advanced determination on one or three or five or maybe all seven or none, or just based on the ones that we think merit the advanced determination.
And Commissioner, I am going to stay away from, you know, any kind of legal interpretation and just focus on really my personal opinion of the portfolio. And I think the record before you and before this commission demonstrates that approving an ADP for the entire portfolio is in the public interest. I think the numbers in our application on page 38 or page 39 and table 1 or table 2, the analysis that Mr. Heidel did, all demonstrate all the benefits of approving it as a portfolio. The other thing I'll just note is, you know, contractually speaking, my job here today is to advocate for the entire portfolio. I have, you know, the company is in a position where we've entered into contracts with IPPs, with other companies, and our job is to get the regulatory approvals and use good faith efforts to do so. And that's, you know, it's a tangential piece. It's an important piece to note. So not only do I think the record supports it, but, you know, I firmly believe that you have all the information to make a decision on the portfolio, to grant ADP on the entire portfolio. But, you know, I would not sit here in good conscience and be able to say, pick one, this one or that one or this one or that one. I think it would create a lot of problems for myself.
Well, I understand that you have an obligation and a belief that all are worthy and should be approved. But if in our deliberations, I mean, it's early in the day, and I'm certain we will have one or more work sessions on this yet. And if things develop that one or more of these do not look appropriate, do you view this as an all or nothing thing, or would you like approval on the remainder then?
Your Honor, may I just direct the witness to page 17 of his direct testimony?
Sure thing.
I may get to the crux of this.
This is Exhibit 3?
Yes.
Commissioner, the answer to my question would be, ultimately, it's this commission's discretion and how you want to approach it. Again, speaking from a policy perspective, how you want to approach the ADP process. And ideally, we would love to see that you grant approval of the entire portfolio. And as I say on lines 6 through 9 of my direct testimony, that we'll deal with what we have to deal with should you come to a different decision.
In your opening comments, you addressed it, and I lost track of where you were, so I was looking for it, and so I guess I really don't know what your answer was, but you addressed the one point that the company had disagreed with Mr. Heidel on the 60-40% financial incentive plan.
Right.
And so there was that initial point of disagreement. The sides have had discussions. What is the result of that?
I'm sorry, I was probably in my own little world there as I was reading this, as I was reading my opening. My understanding, and of course advocacy staff will have a chance to make sure I have this right, which is we have not agreed, meaning we have not settled to a 60-40 split. What we have agreed to is what is more consistent with traditional rate-making principles, which is whatever our actual costs are on an aggregated basis, whatever those are, assuming that they're lower than the amounts that were provided for in our ADP application, will go into rates. So that will be what our rate base will consist of. To the extent that we spend more money than we had provided for in our ADP, on a aggregate basis, we, the company, would have the ability to come back at a later time to demonstrate that our additional expenditures were prudent. And then the commission would have the opportunity to make a decision on whether or not they agreed or not. So I view this as, we call it a soft cap, but what it really means is that we have an incentive to bring the projects in up to the amount that we've included in the ADP, And from the customer's perspective, if we are able to drive those costs below what we've put in the ADP, rates will reflect our actual expenditures as opposed to what we had bid in.
And then you're familiar with Mr. Heidel's original response, correct?
I am.
Do you have that with you?
Maybe.
It'll be in your packet.
I have a number of questions, and just
I do. Yep.
To make sure I understand things. The first one is on page 10. In that bottom paragraph, the whole discussion, I don't know, it just never seemed very clear to me between the 20-year and the 25-year PPA. Is the point here that everything else is that is based on a 25-year period, but this PPA is 20, and so the levelized cost of energy shows up as higher, but if you go the additional 5 years, then it's better again? Or is that what I should read into that?
There's a couple things, and again, this is, if you want to go really deep into this, Mr. Martin can explain this better than I can, but what we were trying to do, and I think Mr. Heidel was trying to acknowledge this, is that for purposes of doing an LCOE calculation, we looked at everything as a 25-year term or a 25-year period. And a lot of that is because most of these projects are rate-based type. They're rate-based. They're not power purchase agreements. And so we're looking at the life of the asset. And so even though this was a 20-year PPA, when we did our LCOE analysis, we just took it out to 25 years. And I think what Mr. Heidel is saying, well, that wasn't probably the most sophisticated or the most accurate way to do it. It's a 20-year PPA. Let's look at the LCOE over a 20-year period. And when you do that, you get a difference in terms of what the LCOE is. And so that's what I interpret this paragraph to mean, is to really correct for the fact that we were approaching it one way, which was to just have everything be viewed over the same 25-year period so that each and every LCOE was comparable to one another. But you could also make the argument that for power purchase agreements, which have a specific term, that you should actually look at the LCOE over the term of that power purchase agreement.
And this is a 20-year agreement mm-hmm. on that particular one.
That's correct.
And so that would be maybe an example of one of the things why Mr. Heidel's ultimate amount of savings for this whole package is less than the companies, that he was looking at a 20-year as opposed to 25, and some of that savings would have been in the last 5 years, correct?
It might be, and that'd be a good question for Mr. Heidel.
Then also in his testimony, I want to go back a couple pages to page 8. He talks, and I made the most notes in here because it was the response and just where I usually like to make my notes from. You probably addressed some of these things in your original testimony too. But he talks about the impact of a significant drop in gas prices mm-hmm. and how that would play out in this. I'm concerned about a significant increase in gas prices. And while I understand that if other things all stay equal, with an increase in gas prices, your savings would probably even be more because of the oftentimes when you're getting this low price energy. But if this has caused the cost of baseload power to go up to the point that it disappears and now you are forced to run the high price gas too much, is there a point when an increase in gas prices can cause a problem in the math on this project?
Hey, Commissioner, it's another great question. And so, you know, from our perspective, what we're looking at with the low gas prices is that puts pressure, as if gas prices were to continue to go down from where they are today, that'll put pressure on the savings that our customers would see from this wind portfolio. As gas prices would go up, the opposite, what would end up happening is the cost of these projects becomes even better compared to market, which means that the savings that our customers would get would actually get bigger. I think the question that you're also getting at here is, well, what happens to, you know, the rest of your fleet, and what happens to other costs that might go up or down as a result of a change in gas prices? Again, that's one of the benefits, I think, one of the strengths of our system is its diversity as it sits today. And so we're not a 50-50 renewable gas system. We are well diversified. So if gas prices start to go up into places that we haven't seen in a while, you're all of a sudden, you take our nuclear fleet, and it's going to be a really competitive resource when gas prices, should gas prices go up. And again, that's the benefit of having a diverse fleet. And so I look at this as adding this wind portfolio at the prices that they're at really provides a nice hedge against a gas price uptick. And that's what we're really trying to communicate in Table 1, and I think on page 38 of our application, and likewise, I think that's what Mr. Heidel was trying to get at, which is, you know, if you see even lower gas prices than you see today, yes, it's going to eat into some of the savings that our customers will see, but the likelihood's pretty low, and we're already at pretty low gas prices, as we said, so...
On page 15 of his testimony, he expressed concerns about certain features of the strategist model.
Sure.
But he felt that my assessment of his testimony is that he felt that whatever those shortcomings are made up for in savings here. But do you agree with his evaluation of the strategist model and these possible shortcomings?
You know, Commissioner, from a very personal level, I've always felt that I think strategists is a tool, and we should be cautious about, you know, relying too heavily on a tool. And so, Mr. Martin has probably heard from me on several occasions about how do we make sure that we introduce other tools to our toolkit to make sure that the information and the analysis that we're getting out of strategist is of the kind that we can depend upon. I think that as you go through and read Mr. Heidel's testimony, he points out some areas where even though there's some concerns over strategists, there are some really conservative assumptions that the company made and used, which help provide a lot more, provide more confidence in the analysis that we provided. Additionally, we also relied upon, you know, ProMod, which is another tool that we have to forecast transmission congestion and things along those lines and using that information into strategists. So a long way of saying, I think that it serves its purpose. I think it's very helpful in terms of showing what some projected benefits could be. But myself personally, I think it's just one of many things that I personally like to look at to make sure that from a business perspective that we're making the right choices.
On the previous page to that, it discusses the wind integration study prepared by InterNex. So that seems like an important part of making this all come together. Can you tell me about InterNex? I'm not familiar with them.
Commissioner, that's going to be a good question for Mr. Martin, so... I'm going to defer to him on that one.
Page before that, I'm just looking for it here. Oh, the very bottom answer on page 13. He says the company will need to rely on MISO for integration of the variable energy resources. Mm-hmm. Do you feel it's appropriate for the state regulatory bodies to rely on MISO for that, or is it the responsibility of the state regulatory bodies to pay attention to and plan for how these things are going to be integrated? Because after all, I feel it is reliability is our responsibility. So I'd like you to respond to that.
Yeah, and that's exactly, I mean, it's a really interesting tension point in some ways. And, you know, I think there's, from my observation and my perspective on the state regulatory side, is reliability and costs. You know, as an economic regulator, it's always, you know, what is the cost and what happens to rates? You know, when I read something like this, what I really think about is MISO's responsibility as a system operator of the transmission system, as well as having a tariff, a federal rate that discusses how things are going to be interconnected to that transmission system so that the power can move across multiple states. I mean, that is MISO's task. That's what they've been tasked and designed to do. And so from my perspective, I look at it as there is a federal rate, there's a federal tariff that exists. It tells us the rules of the road in terms of how we're going to interconnect these generating resources through a process that's been approved by FERC. And MISO's responsibility in studying the transmission system is to tell us at what point, A, can we do it, or B, what do we need to fix in that transmission system so that it can be done. And then there's another component of all of this, which is once it's on the system, these new resources are on, whatever they might be, then how do you actually dispatch them so that the load is all met all across the different places in MISO. And so I think from the state regulator's perspective, you should be concerned about reliability. You should want to make sure that whatever decisions that we as the regulated entity make does not sacrifice reliability. I think what is also in place to assure that, in my book, is a pretty comprehensive set of rules and regulations and ordered tariffs at the federal level. And I think the system can work well together, and it has worked really well together. We have interconnected, we being the industry, have interconnected a lot of wind in the upper Midwest, and we haven't sacrificed reliability as we've done so. So I appreciate the question, though.
Commissioner, I'm gonna interrupt here. I want to make sure my screen went dark here. I want to make sure we're getting this on the record. Unfortunately, it was before possibly that long answer, but let's take about a 5-10 minute break, and let's make sure that we're still on the record. But let's assume the mics are live until we get that sorted out. I apologize, Mr. Chandran. I didn't want to interrupt you.
It's all right. It's a strategic coffee break.
Let's just take a 10-minute break and go off the record.
5, 6, 7, 15. Oh, yeah, I was listening. Somebody grabbed
his. Sorry. Thank you very much.
I think I'm
good. It was just Repute what I've said.
Okay. Line by line.
Anyway, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Screen went dark. It was just a technological faux pas on my part, apparently. So thank you very much. I apologize again for interrupting. I believe there we finished that question, and Commissioner Chrisman was still questioning Mr. Chandarana.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so from where we left off, I guess with your answer, I think I understand your answer, but I'll point out, and maybe I'm getting jaded with all the health care discussion going on in the country these days, but I don't quite share your faith in federal agencies to take care of reliability and to do what is my job. And so I'm really concerned about this. So what consideration has been given to the possibility that maybe other companies in MISO are doing the same thing? And by the same thing, let me explain. I'm aware of another company that is working on a proposal to add wind and add a natural gas plant nearby to counter it. It seems to me in this case it's the company's desire to add the wind and rely on someone else to provide the backup power. And so if one company does that, maybe it still works itself out, a little more transmission upgrades here and there and that type of thing, and maybe MISO can pull it off. But what if other companies are all doing the same thing to quick get in on this PTC fire sale?
Commissioner, I mean, the way in which I process that question ultimately just goes back to how does MISO study all of this? And there is a, in my opinion, a pretty comprehensive way that they go about studying all the wind that's trying to be integrated into the system. In addition to how the wind is being interconnected into the system and studying what the impacts are to the transmission system, there's also a capacity accreditation process that happens on an annual basis. And that's really intended to make sure that on those peak days in different parts of MISO that there's enough capacity to serve the system and do so reliably. And so I look at taking it up a couple levels. I just, again, look at the fact that MISO has a responsibility to make sure that when generation units are being brought onto the system, that the impacts of that are studied on the transmission system. And likewise, that as we go through and plan for given years, that there's enough capacity and energy on the system so that reliability is preserved. And we play within those rules, and that to me is how we go through that process. And I can appreciate the concern of, well, if everybody, you know, kind of dominoes down and basically says, well, I can avoid doing this, I can avoid doing that, do you hit a triggering point where the rules might need to change? And the answer might be yes. But ultimately, that then becomes a process that would, you know, need to happen, and would need to happen in front of FERC, and MISO would be responsible for bringing forward tariff changes to say, you know what, this doesn't work anymore. So, and I can draw upon a few experiences where, again, looking at wind integration or wind interconnection, they have gone through and changed the way that that process works because it wasn't working before. So that's probably the best way I can answer that question.
Ken, I will have a couple questions for Mr. Martin then too on your future plans. I think possibly my last question, if I can find it here. And back to Mr. Heidel's testimony on page 43.
Okay.
The second answer there, he says that the projects will probably be constructed regardless of the commission decision. Do you agree with that?
I do. And the reason I do so is, again, the scope and size of the benefits that this is going to provide to all of our customers is very substantial. And I really feel like the record here supports the fact that this is a good decision for any commission to make. And so I really feel like this is the type of record and joint analysis between both the company and advocacy staff that supports a decision for you to grant the ADP. And to the extent that you don't, I really feel like this is a good economic-based decision, and we will do what we need to do to try to prove that up again. So about that.
No other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you in North Dakota, and I think this is your first time testifying for the commission.
It is my first time testifying. Not my first time to North Dakota, though.
No. I'm aware of that. Okay, so a couple things. A little bit different line from my colleagues, but I would like to pursue kind of the diversified portfolio that you talked about. And I know some of the modeling, this was addressed in some of the modeling, but I just like to cut to the chase and hear you explain how does this new portfolio affect the economics of your existing system. So I'm worried that the more you run the wind and don't run, say, a coal facility, your nuclear facility, over time, those facilities, because their value is running a lot, become a lot more expensive, and having them becomes less appealing from an economic standpoint.
Yeah, and I think that has been kind of an undercurrent of kind of questions too that Commissioner Christman asked too, which, you know, at the end of the day, this wind is at such a price that it's going to run. I mean, and that's one of the benefits of having it, which is the price is so low that when the wind is blowing, it's going to be dispatched and it's going to displace a lot of things. It's important to keep in mind that, you know, it's a significant amount of energy, but it's also a very small amount of capacity. And so when we're talking about the benefit stream associated with our nuclear facility or our coal facility, which are really baseload units, that's where the capacity value proposition really comes in. We're going to need those units on our peak days as well as we're going to need them at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, perhaps when the wind isn't really blowing. And so to me, it really, there has to be some acceptance, you know, which is kind of what you're getting at, which is when you bring on these types of resources at this type of a price, other things are going to get displaced. And those other things are more expensive generating units. And that could be coal, it could be nuclear. That being said, there is a longer term business proposition associated with you know those baseload units, be it a gas unit, a brand new gas unit, a combined cycle, be it a nuclear unit, be it a coal unit, which comes back to the capacity piece. So,
so you're saying you're always going to need the capacity, and for now, the capacity is gained by those resources. You can't get the capacity through the wind. And so we shouldn't really worry about that because you'll have to have the capacity resources to meet your, you know, whatever, 15% over your peak demand or whatever MISO is requiring. And so whether it's the nuclear plants or the coal plants or something else down the road, you'll meet it.
Correct. That's right.
can you talk at all about how the company is thinking about those issues with this new portfolio? I mean, we're just looking at this all by itself right now.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of impact does it have on your broader portfolio longer term? Or what are you guys thinking about there?
In terms of our fleet long term,
mm-hmm.
and how this plays in with that?
Right.
You know, this portfolio of wind resources, I'm going to go back to really what my opening statement talked about, which is As it pertains and relates to the balance of fleet, you know, the decision really was economics and the fact that by adding this, we know that we can deliver a lot of savings to our customers. And so we were not looking at this in terms of, you know, from a business perspective, of course, we are mindful and thoughtful of the fact that we have tremendous responsibility in preserving reliability, in terms of preserving safety, in terms of being cost conscious. And in evaluating our fleet, we have decisions that we have to be thinking about. But at the end of the day, as it pertains to this particular portfolio, there was a couple of triggering events that made it pretty clear to us that we needed to move. And that was PTC step down was a big decision. The size of the benefits was significant. And it's kind of the basis of the record that you have before you right now.
So do I read that as you saying you really haven't analyzed a lot or taken into consideration a broader impact of this into your fleet? It's more of a, it displaces more expensive energy, so we're doing it.
And I think where I'm trying to answer your question, or I'm trying to make sure I get to